I'm Liz Wall.
And I'm Jessica Aro.
Russia test launches a new intercontinental missile that it says could carry nuclear warheads, sending a warning to the US and Europe. Propagandists on Russian TV reacted by musing about such a weapon wiping out New York City. The White House worrying this is a sign that an isolated Putin is growing reckless. Meanwhile, the Russian dictator is eager to capture Mariupol, a city that Russian forces have flattened and have killed thousands of civilians there, among them a 91-year-old Holocaust survivor.
Markus Kolga is a journalist and leading Canadian expert on Russia and Eastern European issues. He's the co-founder and publisher of Up North, an online magazine on the Baltic and Nordic regions. He's also the founder of Disinfo Watch, a project that analyzes and exposes foreign disinformation influence campaigns. Welcome, Markus, to our pod to discuss information warfare.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's such an honor to be chatting with both of you.
We caught you in a really interesting time because today your name has been included in a newly published Russian sanctions list. Please give your thoughts on that.
Well, my name was actually included in a previously published list about 2 weeks ago that was published on the Russian Foreign Ministry website that included a number of Canadian members of parliament and other civil society actors. And then a new list was just published today that included some 60 individuals. Among them were journalists, elected officials, and think tankers, including those in who are part of my think tank, the McDonnell Laurier Institute. And so my Twitter has just been exploding over the past hour or two, and I'm getting a number of media calls to comment on this new list, which is, of course, clearly intended to intimidate Canadian activists and journalists from reporting on the truth of what's happening in Ukraine at the moment.
But obviously, it would not take you from doing just that, right?
Well, no. I think that being named to that sort of a list only adds fuel to the fire and motivates, I think, those of us who are named to that list to continue doing that work. I mean, I think it's a sign of the impact that work is having. And it's, instead of having that effect of intimidating and silencing, it's sort of, we take it as a pat on the back.
I think
a lot of us will just intensify our work.
Yeah, Markus, I mean, that's a compliment. I mean, if there's any sanctions list to be on, that's the one. That's the one that's kind of showing that you're doing a good job.
Yeah, and I think that's how I've taken it. It's not going to keep me from continuing to do this work. Like I said, it'll only, I think my work will only intensify, and I think others who are on that list will probably end up doing the same.
Right. Then let's go to Estonian approach to the Russian warfare against Ukraine. Today, the Estonian parliament has decided to name Russian acts against Ukrainian civilians as genocide, being the first country to do so. What do you think in these times that the Kremlin is waging information warfare globally against us all? Why such decisions are so crucially important, these choices of words and calling the Kremlin's actions for what they are?
Well, it's a great question, Jessica. I mean, as an Estonian, my parents were born in Estonia and fled Estonia when the Russian Soviet army reoccupied Estonia in 1945, and they, along with tens of thousands of other Estonians, fled to Sweden and on to Canada. Look, the Russians have been accusing the Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, Poles, and certainly Ukrainians of targeting ethnic Russians for several years now. suggesting that there have been those governments have taken efforts to curb the rights of those minorities and such. And so they're constantly throwing these accusations against their neighbors and their the way that they're treating or the claim that they claim that those governments are treating Russian minorities. In reality, you know, Russia itself has been engaging in mass human rights abuses all over the place. I mean, starting with, we can look at Aleppo and what the Russian forces were doing in Syria during the Syrian conflict, and certainly in Ukraine. I mean, I don't think that any of us were expecting to witness the kind of horrors that we've seen in places like Mariupol and Bucha. This is, these are war crimes and, quite frankly, genocide, the scale of which we have not seen in a very long time. So it's incredibly important that all Western governments call out this sort of activity for what it is. And clearly it is genocide. And Estonia, quite frankly, it's not alone. I mean, Latvia also has, I think, adopted the Latvian parliament adopted a resolution identifying those crimes as genocide as well. But Estonia has taken an incredible leadership role amongst, I think, all Western nations. The fact that they've sent $250 million worth of lethal defensive aid to Ukraine, leading all other countries, at least by GDP, around the world. And, Estonia is, by taking on this declaration, it's also taking leadership and pushing against Russian narratives about what's happening in Ukraine. And we should, not forget that Russia has, first of all, denied any sort of claims that it's engaging in this sort of genocide, but it's also, trying to justify its war as a form of liberation, of liberating Russian speakers from the Ukrainian government. So identifying what Russia is doing there is absolutely critical. And I think all Western governments need to follow suit.
Speaking of this importance of word choices, you tweeted that columnists who have a limited understanding of Russia, Ukraine, and Eastern European history should take great care to avoid advancing Kremlin narratives that marginalize and whitewash Putin's genocide in Ukraine. And I thought this was interesting and wanted you to elaborate more on this, the way that words matter. And sometimes disinfo can trickle into mainstream articles, mainstream narratives. Can you talk about that a little bit, Marcus?
You know, in Canada, and I think every other Western nation, we have some journalists who are, I think, somehow predisposed or are willing to accept Russian disinformation as fact, whereas they should be, questioning it more often. So in certainly in Canada, because I think because of our large Ukrainian diaspora, and certainly the number of elected members of parliament who have Ukrainian backgrounds, including our Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, who is a well known globally for her criticism of the Putin regime and her advocacy for Ukraine. The Russian embassy here in Canada takes advantage of those journalists who are more open to advancing those Kremlin disinformation narratives. And we've had a couple of those here in Canada, as you mentioned in my tweet the other week, where I got a little bit frustrated with some of these points that were being made in mainstream media here by a couple of columnists who look at defense issues, and these columnists tend to focus on that Russian information narrative about the far right in Ukraine, the Azov Battalion, without giving any sort of real historical context as to who these people are, who Bandera was, what the symbols of Ukrainian resistance were in the Second World War. And they take those historical narratives, mix them in with Russian propaganda, and try to discredit much of the Ukrainian resistance to the Russian occupation as being, there's some suggestions that there are far right elements, neo-Nazi elements that are part of it. Now, is there a kernel of truth to that? Absolutely. There are problems in Ukraine. Ukraine does have some certainly far right elements within it. But I think this is not just a Ukrainian problem, but a much broader problem in Western democracies. You know, we're seeing Marie Le Pen literally challenge Emmanuel Macron for the presidency of France. Marie Le Pen is, of course, the head of the National Front, which is a far right xenophobic political party in France. There are problems with the far right in places like Sweden, in Finland, Estonia, and right here in Canada as well. Most people don't know that. There's an organization called the Proud Boys, which is a far right racist organization. And so singling out Ukraine as being, and that certainly the defenders of Ukraine as having neo-Nazi or far right elements, is intended to discredit them. It's intended to erode Western support for the resistance and for Ukraine, and by just focusing on those very marginal elements, what those journalists are doing are supporting active Russian information operations, because those are the exact same objectives that the Kremlin is trying to achieve. So, Western journalists generally need to be very aware of what those information operations are, especially in the context of the current war in Ukraine, and they need to be very careful not to inadvertently or sometimes perhaps on purpose advance those narratives that again erode support, Western support for Ukraine.
Right. We have a few here. Jessica has a question. I just wanted to also mention that we have a neo-Nazi problem in the United States and a far-right problem in the United States. So the Western countries that you just mentioned probably have a bigger Nazi problem than in Ukraine. So the whole notion of Nazis having anything to do with Russia's invasion is ludicrous. Sorry, Essie.
I would just add to that, Liz, that let's not forget that it's actually Vladimir Putin's own government that has been actively funding far-right movements in many European countries, Hungary, in Greece, in Austria, in Italy, the League, the successor organization to Benito Mussolini's political party. All of these have received support and funding from the Putin regime. So if there's anyone to look at, and never mind, Vladimir Putin's barbaric neo-fascist invasion of Ukraine, but if there's anyone to look at with regards to support for the far right and xenophobia, it's the Putin regime.
Exactly like you say, the amount and level of cynicism and dishonesty that the Kremlin is portraying with these actions and conflicting words is just astonishing. Just never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah.
You listed some really interesting examples of local, like Canadian targeted information warfare activities coming from the Kremlin. Can you please analyze a little bit what kind of impact have these activities possibly had in Canadian citizens or maybe the decision makers?
That's a great question. I think that most of your listeners would be surprised that Canada is actually being targeted by Russian information operations, but it is. And I think a lot of Canadians are actually surprised that we're being targeted. The reason for this is because, Canada is a member of the G7. Canada is also a well-respected member of NATO. We're a very close ally. I would say that the United States is closest allies. And we also have troops, of course, stationed in Latvia as part of NATO's Operation Reassurance, the tripwire mission, to deter any sort of Russian action against the Baltic states. And so all of these factors combined in, I think, make Canada an important target for Russian information operations. Also, as I mentioned earlier, we have a very large Ukrainian diaspora, a very large Central and Eastern European diaspora, and elected officials who are members of those communities. And so what we've seen over the past number of years are information operations directly targeting them. And many of those information operations since really 2014, the invasion of Crimea have targeted the Ukrainian diaspora. And so some of those narratives that we were talking about earlier about the far rights and neo-Nazism, the Russian government has tried to smear the Ukrainian community in Canada with those same narratives, suggesting that their resistance against the Soviet occupation during the Second World War was very closely tied to the Germans. And of course, throughout Europe, there was all sorts of collaboration, unfortunately, with local communities and such with the Nazis. I mean, Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians. Let's not forget France and in Italy, there was unfortunate collaboration with the Nazis all over the place. This was not unique to the Ukrainians, but the disinformation narratives tried to portray the entire Ukrainian diaspora community, of which there are 1.5 million people in Ukrainians in Canada. They try to use those narratives to smear and marginalize the voices of Ukrainian Canadians, essentially trying to make them second class Canadians. There are also conspiracy narratives that are spread to suggest that the Ukrainian Canadian community controls Canada's foreign policy somehow. And, you know, we've seen those sorts of conspiracy narratives before targeting other minority groups in various other places around the world. And all of those are, they're hateful and they're intended to marginalize and silence minority groups. We've also seen elected officials targeted with those same narratives. Chrystia Freeland, who is Canada's deputy prime minister, she's a former minister of foreign affairs and, of course, the current finance minister. She has been an outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin for a number of years. She, of course, is a journalist in Russia in the 1990s and early 2000s. And she was placed on Vladimir Putin's sanctions list, the same one that we were talking about earlier, already in 2014 during the invasion of Crimea. And so her family background, because her grandfather was a journalist and an editor at a newspaper in Lviv during the Second World War, the Russian government, and specifically the Russian embassy here in Ottawa, has over the past 3 or 4 years tried to portray Chrystia Freeland as some sort of a Nazi whitewasher.
This is not the first time Freeland has been targeted by the Russians. She was one of 13 parliamentarians banned from traveling to the country in 2014 in response to Canadian sanctions. And last year, pro-Russian news outlets published similar stories about her grandfather's past. At the time, she compared that situation to Russian efforts to interfere with the U.S. election.
I think that Canadians, and indeed other Western countries, should be prepared for similar efforts to be directed at us.
Based on her family's history and her own resistance and criticism of the Soviet occupation of Ukraine and Soviet repressions in Ukraine, most recently, it was around during the first week of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There was a large rally right here in Toronto, and Chrystia Freeland was at the front of the march that ran through the city center. And someone had placed a red and black scarf in front of the politicians who were at the front of that march. The red and black scarf was, of course, those are the colors of the Ukrainian Second World War resistance. Some might identify it as a Banderist symbol. There are connections to elements that were collaborating with the Nazis during the Second World War. But a photo was, of course, taken, unfortunately, during that march with this scarf and Chrystia Freeland behind it. And that image was picked up by the far right and far left here in Canada. I suspect it was also advanced by the Russian embassy, this narrative that because Chrystia Freeland was standing behind this scarf, that she was somehow, it proved that she was a neo-Nazi. And thankfully that narrative didn't go too far, and it didn't reach the mainstream media and mainstream media that did report on it, reported on it properly with the proper historical context and identified that as a Russian information warfare narrative. And so that entire effort was blunted. But these are the sort of ongoing efforts that that the Russian government is undertaking here to try and silence those vocal critics of the Putin regime, and especially those elected officials, smearing them with that disturbing label.
Sounds really like the Russian embassies in the world nowadays really operate as Russian troll factories, unfortunately. I would like to go a little bit deeper also into the influencing against Canada. So you have also criticized the Canadian government as they have not provided enough support to Ukraine. And in fact, earlier, the Kremlin has threatened the whole international community with serious consequences if they provide any military help or other help to Ukraine. So do you think it's actually possible that the Kremlin, with its threats, has actually succeeded decrease the Canadian or then the Western decision makers' willingness to help Ukraine?
That's a good question. I think that initial Russian disinformation efforts did have an impact on decision making here in Canada. You know, those sorts of narratives that I was mentioning earlier that target the Ukrainian diaspora, the Central and Eastern European community diaspora, those elected officials. I think that, you know, even if you know, Canadians reject those narratives, there's still, I think, a corner of their mind where they might believe that there's some kernel of truth to it. And I think that could provoke some reluctance on making the right decisions as we, you know, we know them today. I think when you combine that with Russian's nuclear saber rattling, you know, I think this has caused considerable concern amongst you know, the less hawkish Canadian, the less hawkish members of Canada's foreign policy community. And I think that that's quite frankly led to a certain degree of reluctance in providing Ukraine the lethal defensive weapons that it needs to defend itself. Now, I think that we, you know, those images, unfortunately, those images of mass civilian destruction, especially those images out of Mariupol where you saw that those apartment buildings, I mean, it's the devastation there was unspeakable, the horror of it. And I think that that led to Canada's decision to send lethal defensive aid to Ukraine. That said, while that decision was very good, and I think that it was very helpful, Canada still unfortunately lags far behind its allies in sending defensive aid. As I mentioned, you know, Estonia leads the way. I mean, this is Estonia is a country that has the population, at least in the Canadian context, that's about the size of Calgary, or, you know, it would be the size of a small American city. That country has sent $250 million worth of defensive aid to help support Ukraine's defense of itself. And Canada, with 40 million, has lagged far behind. So, you know, I wouldn't attribute that completely to or only to Russian information operations, but I'm sure that they have an impact. And it's critically important that Canadian media and decision makers, again, do recognize those sorts of Russian information warfare and what they intend to achieve. One of those things is a reluctance, again, in supporting Ukraine in its war against this Russian invasion.
Right. I have one more question about threatening as a tool of Kremlin's information warfare. Yesterday, journalist Julia Davis, who is monitoring the Russian state propaganda programs and tweets about them regularly, by the way, please, everyone follow her. She's really excellent. And she just pointed out a really aggressive threat. Russian state TV host Vladimir Solovyov threatened Europe and all NATO countries with war and asked whether they will have enough weapons and people to defend themselves once Russia's so-called special operation in Ukraine comes to an end. What would you say we should all make of these specific threats?
Well, you know, I think that these sorts of threats need to be taken, on one hand, seriously. And the reason I say this is that I don't believe that Vladimir Putin is acting rationally at the moment. I think that he is extremely frustrated with his complete failure in this invasion. The way that he has lashed out at Ukrainian civilians, the wanton destruction, the systematic rape of Ukrainian women and young women, the genocide that he's engaging in, all of these are irrational decisions that he's taken. And I wouldn't put it beyond Vladimir Putin to try to potentially invade some other country or attack some other country that borders his country. That said, I think that Vladimir Putin's armies, his generals, his own decision making has proven that his armies are incapable of dominating even a small under-resourced army like the Ukrainian army. I think that that Western governments should look to the success of the Ukrainian army in defending Kyiv and winning that war, that battle of Kyiv. If Vladimir Putin were to ever challenge any NATO country and NATO itself, I think that the outcome would be absolutely disastrous for Russia. And that I would include Sweden or Finland in that. I think that if Russia were to challenge Finland, I think the Western world would run to support Finland. And again, the outcome would be disastrous for Russia. So for all these threats, you know, I would put it, chalk it up to, just bluster. And I think those threats are intended to, again, as all of these other narratives we talked about, are intended to erode support, Western support for Ukraine, to intimidate Western countries, to get them to back off sending weapons to Ukraine. But I think that Western governments would be wise to call Vladimir Putin's bluff on this and just continue doing what they're doing, accelerate their support for Ukraine. And quite frankly, I mean, what we need to be doing is ensuring that the refugees who are still stuck in Mariupol, in Kharkiv and other cities that are under attack from the Russians, to ensure that those refugees can flee to safety by closing off those skies and ensuring that any efforts in the Black Sea, Russian efforts, are also thwarted with surface-to-sea missiles and other systems.
Yeah, Marcus, I agree with you that what we're hearing from Putin is likely bluster for his kind of underperforming military invasion in Ukraine. At the same time, a isolated Putin is likely an unstable Putin, and that can be worrying as well. It seems like the Kremlin wants to declare some kind of victory on May 9th. Like capturing all of Donbass and Mariupol, for example, and Julia Davis, who Jessica pointed out, who watches Kremlin TV so that we don't have to, reports that that Russia, thank goodness for her services there, reports Russia has already began preparations for its Victory Day parade with thousands of marching troops, fighter jets, and the notorious Z formation. And so this is a historical date, May 9th, for Russia. Can you explain, how does the Kremlin weaponize and distort history and historical events to radicalize its own people?
Right. First of all, I want to echo Jessica's point about having all your listeners follow Julia Davis. She is amazing. And she does, as you mentioned, do that incredibly difficult work of keeping an eye on Russian media and sort of reporting back to us what's being said there. Everyone should follow her. On your question about Victory Day and May 9th, you know, history has always been an important tool inside of the Kremlin's information warfare, both targeting its own people and those abroad. And certainly the Second World War, that historic struggle, the Allied struggle of that war against the Nazis and liberating Europe from that that terrible scourge is important for Russians and I think the Western world in general. The problem with the Russian narratives and the weaponization of this history is that it severely distorts that history. You know, starting with the fact that in August of 1939, Hitler and Stalin signed a pact that essentially coordinated the start of the Second World War between them. That pact also carved up most of Europe between Hitler and Stalin. This is a fact and a reality that is not recognized by the Putin regime. You know, and then going beyond that to the end of the Second World War, of course, you know, the Western allies came to Europe and literally liberated it. Freed much of France, Germany itself from the Nazi terror, but then they also helped rebuild it. And once they finished rebuilding it, they left it and allowed Western Europe to flourish on its own. The Soviets, on the other hand, when they quote unquote liberated much of Central and Eastern Europe, that liberation looked very much like the quote unquote liberation that they're engaging in Ukraine right now. It included mass murder, systematic rape, destruction, mass deportations. And unlike the Western powers who left Western Europe, the Soviets never left and didn't leave until 1990. And what Vladimir Putin has engaged in for the past 22 years is a whitewashing and a retelling of that entire history to support his own presidency and his own power. Vladimir Putin, when he looks into the mirror, he sees himself standing beside Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, and of course, most importantly, Joseph Stalin. And what he needs in order to make it appear to his own people that he is the heir, the rightful heir to Joseph Stalin, is to ensure that the Russian people are proud of that Second World War history, their liberation of Eastern Europe, and their defeat of the Nazis. And while we should all be thankful to the Soviets for defeating the Nazis, I think what we need to acknowledge its crimes as well. And this is something that Vladimir Putin has explicitly tried to erase out of that history. Yeah. And so May 9th, that Victory Day, has been built to support those narratives. And quite frankly, to Putin uses that date and this spectacle to support and legitimize his own position as the ruler of Russia. And I think that this year especially, he'll try to do that. He needs a victory, some victory in Ukraine to help I think amplify the importance of that date, because this is something that, given all the failures that Vladimir Putin has had domestically over the past decade in Russia, but also more specifically over the past few weeks in Ukraine, he needs this day and that spectacle to convince his own people that he's made the right decisions in Ukraine and more broadly when it comes to, like I said, Russian domestic politics.
Right. He needs something to brag about amid this genocide. Really quickly, because we have just about a minute left, but I want to ask you, Marcus, because you've been tracking the Kremlin's information warfare for a very long time, before people even really knew that there was an information warfare. In your view, briefly, why is information warfare so dangerous?
Well, I think for Western societies, it's dangerous because Vladimir Putin, it's first of all, it's cheap for Vladimir Putin to engage in it. It has a deep impact. We saw the impact of Russian information warfare on the U.S. presidential elections in 2016. And during COVID, especially, we have seen its effects in tearing apart our society, eroding trust in our mainstream media, our elected officials. And if we don't do something about it, this process will only continue because Vladimir Putin's ultimate objective, at least in Western democracies, is to destabilize them, to undermine them and subvert them. Because he cannot compete with the Western world of Western democracies when we are whole, when we are united. He can only compete with us, and he will win when we are fractured, when we are divided. And that's what he's hoping to achieve. So we need to be aware of that, and we need to defend against that information warfare that he's trying to engage in.
That's right. We must stay united. We must win the information war. And we really do appreciate your work, Marcus, for fighting the information war and educating others from journalists to policymakers on the importance of winning the information war. Marcus, thank you so much for your insight and for joining us.
Likewise, thank you for all your great work in this area as well. And it was such an honor to join you today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marcus. Thank you.